From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The mission of the Christian Research Institute is to equip believers to always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you, to give the reason for the hope that you have with gentleness and respect. For more information, resources, or to donate to CRI, call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. The following program was pre-recorded. And now, here's Bible Answer Man host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy, and I want to talk about the sharpest point of contention between young and old earth creationists, death before Adam. Old earth creationists hold all death, including animal death, to be a function of the fall. Old earth creationists believe that carnivorous creatures and natural catastrophes existed prior to the sin of Adam as part and parcel of God's very good creation. The rift is unnecessary. The false assumption underlying the debate is that Adam's sin necessarily precedes the advent of all evil. Of course, we're not talking about the rebellion of Satan here. And as a result of that, young earthers are constrained to reject astronomical and geological dating, while old earthers are compelled to reinterpret biblical passages that speak of natural evil as a direct consequence of human sin. The reality is this: orthodoxy demands faithfulness to truth in both general and special revelation. An orthodox understanding of the Creator of all things is that He acts transtemporally in creation. And therefore, the cross of Christ can retroactively atone for Adam's sin, just as it proactively atones for the sin of Adam's posterity yet unborn. In similar fashion, there is little difficulty conceiving of a transcendent God who predestines natural evil to precede the fall, even though the fall is the necessary cause of the evils that precede it. Of course, it's natural for us as humans to see time's arrow from a forward perspective. But we would do well to recognize that God's infallible truth is not always presented in chronological fashion. And as such, the advent of the last Adam not only can atone for the sins thousands of years after the advent of the first Adam, but the last Adam is biblically portrayed as a lamb slain from the creation of the world. The bottom line is this: mining the Scripture for all its wealth entails recognition that God's purposes are presented in chronological as well as chirological fashion. I'm going to ask Bill Dembski about that word, chirological, in just a few moments. Bill Dembski is a leader in the intelligent design movement. He's a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. He's a highly regarded mathematician. He's a philosopher. He's done postdoctoral work at MIT, the University of Chicago, and Princeton University, and he has authored more than a dozen books, including The Design Inference and No Free Lunch. And he's also the author of an article in the Christian Research Journal titled Old Earth Creationism and the Fall. And that ultimately is the issue that I want to discuss today. This is one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about this book, The End of Christianity, Finding a Good God in an Evil World. This is another privilege to have Bill Dembski on the air. Good to have you back, Bill.
Good to be back with you.
This is such a significant issue. You have, no doubt, as I have, run into so many people who want to maintain theological integrity. The fall seems to account for all evil. And yet, you look at the data, you look at Star Life, for example, and immediately you think, wow, how's it possible that we live in a 6,000-year-old universe?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, because I think what you have to say is, if science is completely wrong about this, then we are basically seeing just a light show where there are no stars or anything behind it, because the science is telling us that light travels at a constant speed and that we're seeing light from galaxies, star systems that are hundreds of millions of light years away. So that light would have had to travel a long, long time.
And what about people that say to you, well, here's the solution. God created his handiwork with the appearance of age, which is, by the way, one of the subjects you address in the book.
Right. I think it just leads to the question, though, about God's revelation in nature, and is God being forthright there? And what does that do about the honesty of God? Now, I think there's a sense in which perhaps, you know, if Adam, you know, I believe that Adam was specially created, okay, so he'll be a full-grown man. But if he's a full-grown man, is there going to be any genetic evidence that he has aged? Or, you know, that, I think, even if you have something that is mature, it doesn't seem to me that you have to put deceptive marks of age there. And I think that's what we would be dealing with in the science if, for instance, in fact, we're not seeing any further than 6,000 years out, and basically this is just a light show that God has made for us, and there really are no stars out there, or maybe there are, but that history is all bogus. I think that's the question. Is nature speaking truly to us? And I think that is an important issue, and one that the scriptures themselves indicate are an important issue. Romans 1:20 came up last week, where, you know, Paul is saying that from nature, from the creation, we can tell certain things about the invisible attributes of God, that God is a God of glory, that God by wisdom has created the world. Well, if nature is not speaking to us truly, then how can we even draw those sorts of inferences? So I think it becomes a double-edged sword if you try to, you know, maintain this appearance of age, because I think it can end up biting you in the back later.
How significant is this issue of the fall from your perspective? There are so many progressive creationists who are saying, look, what happened prior to the fall is part of God's very good creation. Why is it that you can't stomach that?
Well, it just seems to me, you know, and I came to this through the study of intelligent design. And I mean, I'm looking at signs of intelligence in the natural world. And are there patterns in nature that point us to a transcendent intelligence? And I think there's very good evidence of that. But I look also what the stumbling blocks have been for people accepting that position. And probably the biggest one is the problem of evil, evil in nature. And there's an interesting contrast here. When you look, for instance, at William Paley, he's the watch in the field. You know, if you find a watch, you're going to infer a designer there. Very common watchmaker argument. Well, 50 years later, Darwin takes that argument apart, or claims to, but where he really focuses on is the problem of evil and suffering in nature. If you read Paley's Natural Theology, the biggest chapter is the second to the last chapter. It's about twice as long as any other chapter there. And basically he says, yeah, after all, he goes through all the wonderful things in nature. He says, you know, yeah, there's some death and suffering, but it's really pretty short. Animals don't suffer very long. And he tries to put a nice touch on it. Charles Darwin takes a trip around the world, 5-year trip on the HMS Beagle, and sees the sort of brutality and violence that's out there, humans against humans, but then also within nature. And when you look at some of the things that are going on in nature, it's not just that things are dying or getting sick, but that you've got parasites that seem exquisitely designed to upset a organism. That's where I think you really get some problems. So it seems that this can't just dismiss it as though, well, it's really not that bad and it's not really morally significant, because humans are really not suffering it. In fact, I mean, I would say, you know, the evil that we see in nature, those become our prime metaphors for understanding evil. I mean, when John the Baptist will say, you brood of vipers, you know, I mean, it's things in nature that, as it were, God has put there is a mirror to our own, the sin in our hearts, but that mirror does represent real evil.
That, by the way, is a profound insight, and it's one of the things that you'll find in this book, one profound insight after the other. Darwin did say that. He said, I can't persuade myself that a beneficent, omnipotent God would have designedly created parasitic wasps with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars. And that conundrum ultimately led Darwin to dispense with the notion of a creator God. In reality, however, Adam, not the Almighty, bears culpability for the origin of moral and natural evil in the world. We're going to be talking about that and so much more when we continue the discussion with Bill Dembski on the other side of the break. Again, Dr. Dembski is author of The End of Christianity. We'll be right back with more of Bill Dembski. Stay tuned.
The famous British apologist G.K. Chesterton once noted, "The true soldier fights not because he hates what is in front of him, but because he loves what is behind him. Because at CRI we love what is behind us, our faith, our families, and our freedoms, we will never retreat quietly from the growing assaults on life and truth. Even when the costs are great, we will stand." To join like-minded friends in making a difference at home and around the globe, and to equip fellow believers to stand their ground courageously, become a member of CRI's support team. Simply call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at equip.org. Stay with us. Hank Hanegraaff will return in a few moments. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition is the comprehensive collection of the most often asked questions Hank Hanegraaff has received throughout his four decades as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. With more than 500,000 copies already in print, this newly revised and expanded Collector's Edition helps seekers and skeptics alike sort through the truth on topics such as reliability of the Bible, religions and cults, the resurrection and afterlife, and many more issues vital to a better understanding of God in Christ and our relationship to Him. To receive your copy of the Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Expanded, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making, and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org.
Now back to the Bible Answer Man broadcast and your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Back to the discussion with Dr. William Dembski on the book, The End of Christianity. And before we get too much farther into the discussion, it bears repeating the title of your book, What's the Point?
Well, it's a play on words. I mean, the end there, end can mean the demise, and I think a lot of the atheists would like to read it that way, as the demise of Christianity, but I took it as the purpose or end goal. Where is it all going? What's it all about? And so that's what I was referring to with the end of Christianity.
And of course, the book does deal with a word that many people are not familiar with, but theodicy. How could a good God create a world in which things go so desperately wrong? In other words, we're dealing with the problem of good and evil that we encounter in the world, and at first blush it may seem as though there are as many responses to that question as there are religions. But truthfully, there are only three. Pantheism denies the existence of good and evil because God is all, and all is God. And then, of course, philosophical naturalism, which is the worldview that undergirds evolutionism, it supposes that everything is a function of natural processes, brain chemistry, genetics, and the like. Therefore, there is no good, there is no evil. So we come to the conclusion that theism alone has a relevant response, and only Christian theism has a satisfactory response. But it seems that evangelicals, or people within the evangelical Christian world, are mucking things up. And I want to read a quote that you have in the book. That quote is from Tony Campolo, where he says, God has chosen to not be all-powerful. If God were in control of everything, there would be no such thing as human freedom. In the economy of God, love is more important than power, and therefore the loving God, in order to give us the capacity to love, has limited power, and thus when there are tragedies, he's the first one who cries. What kind of a God is this? What does that do to our fundamental concept of who God is?
Well, I think Tony is moving in this whole open theism, process theism approach, which has very much taken the evangelical, at least certain portions of the evangelical intellectuals, by storm. And it seems to me that that position is just incoherent. I mean, you can't, it certainly doesn't agree with the Christian tradition orthodoxy here. I mean, there's just no way. I mean, divine omnipotence, that God is sovereign, that he is in control, that everything, that he's almighty, that everything is subject to him. I think that's been orthodoxy across the board, Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, Catholic, right along. But this idea, I mean, you know, the classic notion is that God simply restrains himself. He does not interfere with human freedom, or he allows people to muck up things, you know. But to say that God has, as it were, put himself in a prison, thrown away the key, and now he can't get out, it seems to me that that's just incoherent. So, Tony, I've watched him over the years. I mean, he had a book in 1984, The Power Delusion, which I actually enjoyed, where this theme of power came up. And I think, yes, in the life of Jesus, Jesus didn't flatten the Romans. He did restrain his power. But it's one thing to restrain one's power. It's another thing to give it up entirely. And so in that passage you read afterwards, I make the comparison with King Lear, who did give up the power, and then suddenly things spin out of control. I mean, the problem with this view is, if God has really given up the power and we are free, what guarantees are there that God is going to be able to pull it off, that love will triumph? It's a position that I think really doesn't offer any hope in the end.
There are people, though, Dr. Dembski, who will look at your book and think, you know what, you've got a problem as well, because you have a benevolent God who allows natural evil to afflict the world prior to Adam's sin. How in the world is that a coherent view of God?
Well, I mean, if you're going to take that view, then I think you're also going to have to find fault with God for allowing evil in families where parents sin and it affects their children. I mean, it seems that somehow in this life, humans are at the pinnacle, they are the covenant heads, And what they do does affect the rest of creation. And it's this is the way the world has been structured. I don't think I've got anything really much more to offer beyond that. I mean, we're all complicit in this life. So God includes us all together, and the animal world as well. And the animal world suffers because of the sin of Adam. But, I mean, I think the broader theological issue there is that God is doing this to bring good out of this. And I think an important theme here is that natural evil is allowed because it points up our own evil, the evil in our hearts. We need, as it were, natural evil to keep us honest, to bring us to our senses. What would happen in a world in which we are fallen, corrupt human beings, but there is no natural evil? We don't get sick. We can live out our lusts, live out our evil desires, and do so without any restraint, without anything to bring us back to sobriety. That's actually, I think, a very terrifying prospect. So natural evil, if you will, is a grace. I mean, it's and what we said in the earlier portion of this program, you know, that this natural evil is a mirror to our own selves. I mean, you think about the scriptures. I mean, all the images of evil, the wolf in sheep's clothing, you know, the wolf. I mean, that's something from nature. The serpent, you brood of vipers, the snake in the Garden of Eden. I mean, so there are these images, they're really primal, taken from nature, that point up evil. And I think it's part of, if you will, God's school in educating us and bringing us to our senses.
I thought there was a profound insight in the book, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but perhaps I can lead you to think about this aloud with our audience for a couple of moments. But the profound insight was somewhere in the book where there was this aha moment. Adam and Eve, they sin, and now they don't have to wonder what the consequences of sin would be like. They're cast into a world where they see it up close and personal. They're brought face to face with the gravity of their sin because it is already extant.
Well, yes, I think perhaps the chapter you're referring to is the one where I do an interpretation of Genesis 1 through 3. And the question is, I mean, if indeed we have our fall is responsible for natural evil, but natural evil still precedes the fall. I mean, this is where it gets a little bit science fiction-y. I mean, you've got backward causation, as it were. But from a divine vantage, it's not a problem because God is, as we said, transtemporal. He's not bound by time. Indeed, He created time. So if God basically anticipates the fall through the fall in nature with natural evil, then Where does that evil reside as Adam and Eve come on the scene? And this is a point I make then in that chapter that I'm referring to. You've got Adam and Eve; they're put in a garden. Now, the garden, paradise. I mean, there are a lot of primal images and metaphors connected with that. But why does God put them in this segregated area when, on a young Earth view, for instance, I mean, the whole world, everything is perfect, you know? But they're put in this garden, and then when they get ejected from the garden, they want to go back, but the angels block them, and now they're in a world with thorns and natural evil. And so it seems to me that there are even exegetical grounds for this retroactive view of the fall that I describe in the book.
And of course, one of the things that we want to learn to do is read the Bible for all it's worth, or, as I like to say, mine the Bible for all its wealth. One thing that I want to discuss before we're out of time, the issue of chirological versus chronological. We don't have a whole lot of time, but tackle that for a moment because those are big words and people oftentimes don't have a radar fix on what they mean.
Right. Well, in English, we just have one word for time, but the Greeks, they had two. They had chronos, which is usually what we mean by time, the sort of sequential one thing happens after another. But they had also kairos, which was time with a purpose, the time for something to be fulfilled. And you can actually get that meaning if you look at Arnton Bauer's New Testament Greek dictionary. That distinction is made between kairos and chronos. And so, if you will, kairos, then, the way I develop it, it's God's time. It's how, you know, in the, if you will, the thoughts, the mind of God, how do things lay out? And the way God lays things out in his purposes isn't necessarily, doesn't follow a sequential pattern as our chronological time does. And so what I argue is that Genesis 1 really is, in the first instance, it's chirological time, it's God's time, which is not to take away that what's happening there doesn't also happen in chronological time, if you will, but that there is that distinction. And so it actually allows for a reading of Genesis 1 and 2 where, if you will, Genesis 2 is Chronos and Genesis 1 is Kairos. And so I think it offers some insights into just how God acts in the world without being bound to the structures of the world.
Well, Bill, be encouraged. You're making a difference in the lives of a lot of people. I deeply appreciate you and your work, and we continue to pray that God will richly bless and use you for His glory and for the extension of His kingdom. You are a much-needed voice in the Christian world.
Thank
God bless you.
Likewise, I feel the same way about you, Hank.
God bless you, dear friend. We'll see you next time with more of the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
You've been listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To learn more about Hank or the Christian Research Institute, just go to equip.org. Equip.org is a fountain of information and resources designed to help you defend the faith and grow in your knowledge of the truth. You can also stream the broadcast live or download archived broadcast. To talk with a resource consultant by phone, call 888-7000-CRI. Or you can write to us at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is supported by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition is the comprehensive collection of the most often asked questions Hank Hanegraaff has received throughout his four decades as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. With more than 500,000 copies already in print, this newly revised and expanded Collector's Edition helps seekers and skeptics alike sort through the truth on topics such as reliability of the Bible, religions and cults, the resurrection and afterlife, and many more issues vital to a better understanding of God in Christ and our relationship to Him. To receive your copy of the Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Expanded, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org.